I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object.
Beyond the glitz and the glamour, a world of murder, mayhem, mystery, and scandal. Can your heart stand the shocking facts of
The Dark Side of Hollywood?
Featuring Parallax View's very own Matlock, veteran journalist Albert Lanier. On this edition of the show, we examine the cold case murder of actor Bob Crane, known before his death for starring in the popular television sitcom Hogan's Heroes, and after death for his scandalous sexual escapades. So sit back and relax. Grab a glass of wine, because it's true crime time. On Parallax Views presents
The Dark Side of Hollywood.
Welcome back to Parallax Views, returning guest, one of my favorites, Albert Lanier.
All right, GG, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good tonight, and you and I want to do something different for this episode of Parallax Views, a bit of a Hollywood true crime story, since that is really, really popular right now. You know, there's a this podcasting company called Wonderly. They basically specialize in Hollywood true crime podcasts. So this is like a big deal right now, and I've always liked a good true crime story and a little bit of that lurid Hollywood sort of excess type story. That's pretty popular now too with that new Tarantino movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So, you know, I think we're going to cover a pretty interesting case. What case are we covering tonight, Albert?
We're going to be looking into the death of Bob Crane. And just to let people out there who may not be familiar with who Bob Crane was an actor. Before that, he was a drummer. And just prior to being an actor, and even during the time he was an actor initially, was a DJ. He worked for radio stations in L.A. and before that, in various other parts of the U.S., various other parts of the country. So Bob Crane was the star of a show called Hogan's Heroes, which was a comedy about a prisoner of war camp during World War II. It ran for several seasons on CBS in the mid-60s to, I think, early 70s. And then Bob himself ended up doing other kinds of acting gigs. He was in a couple of Disney movies, but he ended up being murdered in Scottsdale, Arizona in 1978, more specifically June of 1978. And he was there in Scottsdale as part of a run of a play called Beginner's Luck at a dinner theater in Scottsdale. And that's what brought him to Scottsdale, Arizona. And unfortunately, that is what ultimately ended up leading to his death. The fact that he was there, he was doing the play Beginner's Luck, which he had bought the rights to and was performing with the cast. I believe he's also directing it. And so Bob Crane was known for Hogan's Heroes, ended up dead before the age of 50. I think he was 49 when he died. And so we're going to look into his death. And this is always a case that's intrigued me. Normally, I'm interviewed about a great number of things on podcasts and talk shows. And the reason I'm discussing this is this year's my 10th anniversary in terms of discussing, being interviewed on all kinds of shows, radio and podcast, internet, so forth. And I was thinking it'd be interesting to try something different in terms of subject matter and issues, because normally I talk about things that are either historic or political or intellectual to some extent, policy-oriented, issue-oriented. I thought, I've long been interested in this case, the death of Bob Crane, and I thought it would be worth discussing. It's, I guess, in terms of marketing, I don't try to think of myself in terms of marketing when it comes to being interviewed, but I guess I'm kind of expanding, you know, I'm not just sticking to a narrow focus here or a narrow brand, quote unquote. So, we'll see how this goes, and we'll see how people react to it. You know, I don't really know if there's a constituency for my interviews or for me. I'm just a local and regional freelancer who's retired. So,
well, I was going to say, this case and sort of Bob Crane's life as a whole, it seems actually oddly, how shall we put it, it seems oddly relevant in this day and age, not just because you have all these, you know, true crime podcasts and Hollywood scandal podcasts, but it just seems relevant, as we'll find out, to the sort of Me Too era in a way. There's a lot of, there's a sexual element to this story, but we'll get to that in a second. Maybe for listeners, as you said, that don't know of Bob Crane, he was on Hogan's Heroes, and this was actually a really big show. You know, it was a sitcom. I believe it took place in Stalag 13, Prisoner of War, sort of comedy drama. But Bob Crane actually won awards for his, you know, starring role on Hogan's Heroes. This was not just some B-list actor. He was an A-list guy.
Well, you know, Bob was on Hogan's Heroes. Hogan's Heroes was considered controversial at the time it debuted on CBS. It was considered to be in bad taste. After all, it is a sitcom about a prisoner of war camp during World War II. So he's playing Colonel Hogan, and he's with other prisoners in their bunk, their cell, and they have to deal with the Nazi commandant and the other German guards. I mean, you're talking about when it debuted was in 1965. World War II had been over for about, what, 20 years at that point? Close, about 20 years? So, yeah, some time had passed since the end of World War II, but this was really considered very sketchy in terms of material.
Well, it's always been a fascinating show to me because it really sort of portrays the sort of the Nazis that are holding them prisoner. The Eichmann type characters is basically a bunch of blithering idiots, of buffoons. So it is sort of pushing the envelope in that regard.
Right. Well, the whole point of that is, you know, it's about the fact that Colonel Hogan, played by Crane, is always looking for ways to outwit and outlast, to steal a couple of lines from the TV show Survivor, the German commandant and the guards. And so it's all about planning their escape and finding ways to escape, and or finding ways to get what they want in the camp. Basically, in many respects, Hogan's Heroes was kind of a ripoff of Starlight 17, the movie.
That's the Otto Preminger movie, right?
I'm not sure who the director of that was, but Starlight 17 was a movie set in a POW camp.
No, I was wrong. It was Billy Wilder. I can't believe I got that wrong.
Mm-hmm. But there's also you also have so that's an influence. Of course, there is the movie The Great Escape, a rather infamous movie with Jim Garner and Steve McQueen. So you had sort of those elements in the ether in terms of film and TV. The Great Escape, Starlight 17. You didn't have anything like Hogan's Heroes on TV. So that show stood out. So it's kind of risky material.
So Bob Crane gets famous through Hogan's Heroes. That lasts, I believe, from the late 60s to the early 70s, correct?
It was about 65, I believe, when they debuted, till about early 70s.
So that's his sort of first taste of success. What sort of unravels with Bob Crane after sort of blowing up with Hogan's Heroes, and maybe after Hogan's Heroes sort of sputters out? What do we know about Bob Crane's life?
Well, basically, after Hogan's Heroes, you know, Crane ended up doing guest spots on different TV shows, which is what he was doing prior to Hogan's Heroes. He was on, I think he was kind of a recurring on Donna, before Hogan's Heroes, before he got the lead in Hogan's Heroes, he was a recurring on the Donna Reed Show. I think he had done shows like the Dick Van Dyke Show, guest spots there. And so afterwards, he was, I think, also doing guest spots. Like I said, he had done a couple of Disney movies. In fact, I think one of the movies that he did was a movie called Super Dad. But he wasn't really finding a vehicle that could match Hogan's Heroes, which was a pretty long-running show.
Well, I was going to say, in 1975, NBC actually gave him his own series, The Bob Crane Show, and it was canceled after only 13 episodes.
Right. So the Bob Crane Show, that was his chance to try to do something different. It didn't really succeed. It may have been that Bob was partly typecast as an actor because he was playing essentially this rather, you know, slightly heroic, wise-ass type character. So it was a combination of playing this guy who's a colonel and thus a sort of hero type of sorts, but not the generic hero type. He was kind of a, you know, wise ass. He was kind of wiseacre, wisecracker sort of guy. And I think he sort of got typecast, because the thing about Bob Crane is that Crane essentially wasn't an actor. Before he became an actor, he was working in radio as a disc jockey, and he had worked his way up throughout the country, as a lot of guys in radio do, to eventually become the morning guy on a station in L.A. called, I believe it was KNX. And so he interviewed a great number of celebrities, you know, on his show, because he's there in Los Angeles, he's there in L.A., and so he's getting people from TV shows and movies, and so he was a morning guy, and in radio, I did radio briefly before becoming a writer and journalist. In radio, the money-making slot is morning drive, because that's where everybody listens to radio. If you listen to radio, you listen to it in the morning. People get up, get in their cars, and they also may get up at home, they want to listen to something. If they don't turn on the TV, turn on the radio, and they listen to what's on the radio, what the weather's going to be like, or what's going on with the news or what have you. Even in this internet era, you know, if people are going to listen to the radio, it's going to be in the morning. And he was a morning drive guy.
And he was known, so, he became the king of the Los Angeles airwaves. That's how a lot of people right. described him. He was interviewing Marilyn Monroe, Frank Sinatra, Bob Hope. He was a huge deal in the Los Angeles area.
Yeah, and you know, because you're in L.A. in regards to radio and television is one of the biggest markets in the country. It's one of the top-tier markets. It's basically, I would say, L.A. and New York. So his making it as a morning drive guy in Los Angeles was a huge deal. It basically, he was at the top of his career in regards to radio. So as a radio disc jockey, he was basically, I would say, at the pinnacle of his career.
Well, I was going to add to that. I think people often underestimate how much just doing work in the entertainment industry in L.A. can sort of just push you into the stratosphere. I mean, think of a guy like in the 80s, Morton Downey Jr. doing his sort of trash talk show routine. I mean, eventually he ends up doing, you know, movies because of it and TV roles where he's almost satirizing himself. So doing a talk show can open up doors into other areas in the entertainment industry, especially in L.A. or New York.
Right. Well, as a brief sideline distraction here, since you brought up Morton Downey Jr., I remember watching the Morton Downey Jr. show back in, I think it was 1988. Hope I have that date right. But in 1988 or the late 80s, I remember seeing a show. At the time, it was, I don't want to say a national phenomenon, but it was talked about nationally. There really wasn't anything quite like it. If that show were to come back now, it wouldn't be anything special. But back then, you didn't see shows like that on the air with ranting and raving audiences. I mean, audience was almost like a mob. I mean, the whole tenor of that show was something that, you know, that you would probably see a little of on your average, even on some of these cable TV panel shows, not quite the same, but that sort of shouting, that kind of attack style mode of interviewing is now kind of part of everyday life in the TV news business, although it's minimized extremely and it's sort of parceled out in sort of small dollops.
Well, I would definitely agree on that. Getting back to Bob Crane, though, so he's sort of the king of the Los Angeles airwaves, and you know, from there he sort of wiggles his way into even greener pastures. I believe he had a Carl Reiner on his show, and he sort of got Reiner to book him for a guest appearance on the Dick Van Dyke Show, and he just keeps blowing up from there.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. He was a disc jockey, but he was somebody who wasn't what we'd call a spinner, somebody who played records. He was somebody who basically was the literal embodiment of what they call a personality. It's what DJs are often called, is a radio personality. That was literally what Bob was. You know, he's somebody who's very quick, somewhat witty, on-the-fly responses, and somebody who could keep people laughing and, I guess, tuning into the show. And he was, like I said, at the top of his game in regards to radio in Los Angeles. And he was earning six-figure salary being the morning drive guy at KNX in L.A. I mean, he was basically at his zenith. And I think the transition to acting sort of made sense because when you're in a place like L.A., you've got the film and TV industry there. And so it's a transition, no matter what your industry is, or no matter what your profession is, to kind of move into acting in many respects in L.A. So I don't think it's that unusual. But he was in broadcast, so it made sense. So he started getting into acting. He was doing shows like the Dick Van Dyke Show, because Carl Reiner was one of the producers and one of the writers on the Dick Van Dyke Show. And he also did shows like Lawrence Welk, Jack Benny, Alfred Hitchcock Presents. So he was doing a number of shows, and he ended up being kind of a recurring character on the Donna Reed Show. And this required him to get up very early in the morning, drive to the studios in Hollywood, I believe it was, to do his morning show, and then head to the studio and do the rest of the day and I don't know how much of the night shooting the Donna Reed Show. And that was a very tough schedule. I've been an actor here in Hawaii locally for about 8 years as a sideline. And I know from what few local film projects I've done, it's really tough. And he must have had a lot of energy and a lot of vim and vigor to deal with that schedule, because it's a tough schedule to get up early, go out and do a radio show for a couple of hours, and then go to a studio and shoot the TV show for hours on end.
And obviously very confident too, because as you pointed out, when he dies in June of 78, he's only 49. So he starts tasting success pretty young.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like I said, his trajectory was, I mean, he was reaching the pinnacle in terms of radio, pretty much, by being a morning drive guy in KNX. And then he starts doing, you know, guest shots on TV shows at the period. And he gets a recurring on the Donna Reed Show, which was a good solid hit show in the 50s. And that sort of lays the foundation, and he ends up being considered and basically getting the lead in Hogan's Heroes, and that becomes a hit show. So the foundation is being laid in terms of the acting foundation. It's being laid by all the work he's done before. Because that's how it is in terms of TV and film, is that you have to be able, you can't just come out of nowhere and become a lead on the TV show. That has to be what they would say years ago. There's got to be some film on you. And Bob had done enough guest appearances and guest shots on TV shows that he could be considered for a lead on Hogan's Heroes.
Well, before we move into the murder of Bob Crane, as it were, is there sort of a downfall story to all of this as well? I mean, we see a lot of Hollywood actors, especially in the past, they have a tremendous rise to fame. Some of my favorite actors, people like Aldo Ray, Cameron Mitchell, they had this tremendous rise, and then due to various reasons, a lot of times because of their own vices, we see a really hard downfall. Does that happen after Hogan's Heroes for Bob Crane?
Well, it depends on what you mean by downfall. In terms of the industry, there's a rating system known as a TVQ. And it's how, basically, in a shorthand, it's how well you go over with an audience. You know, because television is essentially an advertising medium that has entertainment as a way of luring people in to watch TV so that they can go out and buy products. So they're trying to sell products to you. They're trying to sell items to you. The companies are trying to sell what they have to offer to you, whether it's cars, whether it's alcohol, whether it's soda, whatever they're trying to sell, that's essentially what television is. It's an advertising medium. And I guess people don't describe TV that way, but that's the reality of what TV is. So Bob had a big TVQ rating, which meant that he had a pretty loyal audience and people were very interested in him as a personality, which is probably one of the reasons he got what ended up being the Bob Crane Show. And that, as you mentioned before, lasts about 13 episodes, and didn't go over. I don't think he was able to find the vehicle, as I mentioned before, that works like Hogan. In a sense, Hogan's Heroes was tailor-made for Bob Crane. That character had the kind of personality that Crane had. And so it was an easy fit. And as I mentioned before, I think I pointed this out, Crane essentially wasn't an actor. And he was a radio guy who became an actor. He wasn't a trained actor. It's not like he went to Juilliard or some conservatory, or I'm not aware that he even took acting classes. He may have, but I'm not aware, and in my research, I haven't found anything like that. I think he was a guy who sort of was in the right place at the right time and managed to build up enough roles in terms of TV that he could go and eventually become a star. So afterwards, it's like anything. It's a fickle business. And you could be, as the song goes, riding high in April and shot down in May. I mean, it's really kind of that cruel, and it's really kind of that brutal in many respects. Being successful doesn't guarantee success. I think Bob tried to find that spark, that kind of, in a sense, that flair that would either be dramatic or comedic that would work for him. And I don't think he ever did find it in terms of his career, which is why he was doing dinner theater. You know, he was going out on the road and doing shows across the country and doing this romantic comedy, Beginner's Luck. And it's a shame, really, you know. It's a shame. I mean, I liked Bob in many respects. I thought he was, I thought he was a good guy in some respects. There were things about his life I couldn't quite get behind and things that I may not have agreed with, but I'm sure that people felt the same. But the impression I got of Bob was that he was pretty much a very likable, very pleasant, very nice guy. And I think that was the impression that he gave to a lot of people.
Well, you know, the other part of this story, right, before we get into the murder, is that there's a lot of things that people didn't know about Bob before he was murdered, and probably a lot of these things people didn't want to know, so to speak.
Well, there was his private life, and once he was found murdered in June of 1978, basically his private life was exposed and made public, and it's been in sort of, I would say, not quite an open secret, but basically revealed since his death, you know, more than 30 years ago. And it's a shame. Like I said, I thought Bob was a nice guy. I think he treated people for the most part decently, and I think that's important. And I know there are people out there who may look at him and go, oh, he was sleazy. Oh, he was scuzzy. Oh, he was, you know, a horny guy. Yeah, he was a guy who had sexual appetites. And some of his choices in regards to his how he made his sexual appetites known to people, I kind of cringe at. It's sort of like, you know, but he was very open about his marital issues, divorce issues, about his sexual proclivities. And I find myself utterly astonished at that. I can't say that I'm totally surprised, because there are people who are an open book, and I guess Bob was one of those people, but I'm still rather astonished at how blatantly open he was about his, especially his sex life. It's really, in many respects, sadly fascinating.
Well, I mean, so I guess what we're getting at is that Bob was the kind of guy, despite being married from 1949 to 1970, he really liked his sexual relations with women. And it went a lot farther than that. Maybe that's how we can segue into the character that plays a large role in the murder case, John Henry Carpenter, and their sort of relationship and why they sort of become friends.
Well, John Carpenter was a guy, he was a former Marine. He had served in Korea, came out and he started working in electronic companies. He was working for, I think, Lear Aircraft and installing radios in airplanes, or putting radios in airplanes for Lear. He was working for sort of electronic companies, and he had ended up working at, I believe it was Sony, and he was trained to basically install VCRs, or what were the early forms of VCRs, meaning video cassette recorders. And so what John ended up being was really kind of a sort of electronics and high-tech appliance guy to the stars, and he was helping various celebrities install VCRs, install electronic equipment in their homes. I think people like Alfred Hitchcock, for example. So Bob was one of the celebrities that he helped set up his VCRs, electronic equipment. That's how he met Bob. I believe it was on the set of Hogan's Heroes, if I'm not mistaken. Certainly, John was on the set of Hogan's Heroes at various times, but I believe they had met on the set of Hogan's Heroes. That's how they first met, because John knew a number of celebrities. I believe he also knew Richard Dawson, who ended up being the host of the hit game show Family Feud, and Dawson was in the cast previously, at that time, was in the cast of Hogan's Heroes.
Yes, from what I've read, Dawson actually is the one that brought Crane and Carpenter together.
I think Dawson may have introduced them, yeah. I think that's right. I think Dawson did introduce them.
So John Henry Carpenter and Bob Crane, they sort of strike up a friendship, and they begin going to bars and whatnot together, and Bob Crane being Bob Crane, the star of Hogan's Heroes, he has a way with the ladies, and this will all sort of tie in, right?
Right. Well, what I think helped bring Bob and John together, besides the fact that Bob was into electronic equipment, he was into what was then a video recording equipment at the time, very early on, cameras, VCRs, other kinds of equipment. That was one thing that brought them together, because having John as a friend meant that John could fix his equipment or adjust aspects of the VCR or the camera or the TV. So that was one aspect of having John as a friend for Bob. The other aspect was the sexual aspect. They were both guys on the make. So they were about town looking for the ladies. So what they had was their shared interest in sexual conquest and basically getting as much, getting laid as much as they could.
Well, and I want to cut in here because, some of our listeners may have seen the movie Auto Focus, which is actually about Bob Crane and the homicide of Bob Crane. And it's heavily implied in that movie that Carpenter may have been bisexual, and there may have been like this sexual attraction that he had to Bob Crane, but I'm not sure there's actually any evidence of that.
That's been one of a number of things in this case that I'm personally irritated with. I think it's easy to kind of take shots at John Carpenter, who, to be fair, I'm not a fan of. I can't say that I was ever... I can't say that I was ever someone who ever respected John. I thought John was largely a hanger-on in terms of his friendship with Bob, and that Bob was probably better to John than John was to him. I understand that when they went out, you know, Bob used to introduce John as his manager, which probably got a lot of ladies interested in him that normally wouldn't be. So it was a classic kind of sort of co-pilot relationship, you could say. Pilot, co-pilot relationship, wingman. And but the problem that I have with what Carpenter's sexuality was in this aspect is it begins to get into a motive for why Carpenter was seen as a suspect in the death of Bob Crane. The belief is that Carpenter was bisexual or to some extent homosexual. From all indications that I can see in looking into this case, Carpenter himself was clearly at least heterosexual when it came to ladies. It's clear that he had interest in women and was involved sexually with women. Now, he may very well have been bisexual, but what I don't like is the inference that this was somehow the motive or that this was the foundation of Carpenter possibly slaying Crane. I think that's kind of ridiculous, personally. Not necessarily illogical, but I think it's kind of ridiculous. It seems like something that's really kind of cobbled together and put together to provide a motive for why Carpenter might be considered the major suspect in the death of Bob Crane. And I didn't like, in Autofocus, I didn't like the implication that Carpenter was interested in Crane in that way, because it was clear from their friendship, and Carpenter knew Crane well enough, especially if they're involved with having sex with multiple women, that Crane himself was straight, that he was heterosexual. And so Carpenter knew this, and it strikes me as odd that he would think that he could get away with trying to hit on or proposition Bob. I don't see that happening.
Well, you know, I think what we're sort of getting at, maybe we should back up just a little bit here, is that these two men are sort of brought together because they're both into video and photography, and they also share a liking for, you know, the ladies. And that sort of culminates in the seediest aspect of the Bob Crane story for many people. You know, they were actually videotaping and photographing their sexual... I don't know what to call it. They're sexual escapades.
Right. I refer to Bob Crane's many videotapes of his sexual exploits as love tapes. Now the term is sex tapes that we use now, but I'll refer to them as love tapes because he was making love to these women. And what Bob would do is he would travel with all this video equipment, very bulky, boxy video cameras at the time in the late 70s, plus tripod, plus television, plus VCRs, plus timers, and all kinds of other equipment with him for every city that he was on tour with for Beginner's Luck. And so when his body was found in June of 1978 at a place called Winfield Apartments in Scottsdale, Arizona, he had all this equipment in the living room. In fact, he had closed the drapes so that this would be were unseen by neighbors or by anyone in the neighborhood. He wanted to make sure this was not the setup and all the video equipment was not glimpsed by anyone. And so I guess he could better facilitate his what I call love tape session.
Why love tapes? I'm just curious. Because I guess some people would see that as being too kind to Bob Crane, maybe. Why do you think that's a more appropriate term.
Because he was making love to these women, and from what I understand in terms of Bob's personality and the way he conducted himself, he was, a very kind of genuinely nice, friendly person. And I think when it came to the women that he had sex with and the women that he was involved physically with, I don't think there was ever anything untoward. I don't think there was anything sketchy or rude or impolite. So that's why I say I think that he was making love to these women. It's just his personality. I don't see any indication that Bob was somebody who was anything but above board as a person. Now, again, the thing that kind of disabled him was this not so much sexual addiction, as some would term it now, but being into taping and photographing. The taping to me was the part that went over the line, because he was taping all kinds of sex acts with women that he was physically intimate with. And obviously, most of these women had to have known that they were being shot, that they were being taped by Bob. But some may not have known. It seems unlikely, but some may very well have not have known. And I think this is where he went out of the line, this is where he went way over the line. And this is one of the things I don't approve of when it comes to Crane's life. I mean, my view is that his private life is his private life. If he liked having a great deal of sex, that was his business as far as I'm concerned. But once you start taping people, photography is another deal, but once you start taping people, that's a whole different matter. And you never know where those tapes could end up. Now, granted, this was the 70s, and VCRs were not yet ubiquitous. So it's not like you had the internet where you had video sharing platforms and you could spread this sort of stuff all over. So it would be relatively private and relatively minor application in regards to who could see it and who couldn't, in regards to these, as I call them, love tapes.
I was going to say, it's not like, when Pamela Anderson and Tommy Lee just released their sex tape to the world.
Right. You couldn't do that in 1978, and nor would he want to. But his sexual life was, I think, known to some extent within Hollywood, within the film and TV industry. There was talk. It was very clear that he had a reputation as somebody who wasn't just a ladies' man, somebody who liked to use the vernacular screwing around, to be so blunt. Sorry, I'm so blunt, or crass. But somebody who was doing more than that, and who was into various other aspects of sexuality. I believe swinging was one aspect of sexuality that Bob liked to some extent. And so it wasn't simply he was having affairs with women. I mean, he was married a couple of times. His first wife was Anne. His second wife was Patty. And it's very clear that he was cheating on them with various women throughout the marriage, or throughout the marriages, I should say. So I think that's one aspect. I think the issue with Bob was the proclivity and the extent, not only of his sex life, but his brands of sexuality. So that I think was the problem, in at least in regards to film and TV industry.
This also gets into another area. So we've already sort of mentioned that John Henry Carpenter is usually looked at as the primary suspect. But, I mean, Bob Crane was, videotaping a lot of his sexual encounters, right? So I could see other people having motives that we may not even know about.
Right.
You know, like a jilted male lover of one of these women, or maybe a woman was mad at Bob Crane for, you know, not committing to her. I mean, there's all kinds of possibilities for people that would have had an issue with Bob Crane.
Yeah. I have to say, and I don't know how people who have looked at this case and those who have who are fans of Bob and know about this case, and those who are interested in, you know, Hollywood mysteries like the death of Bob Crane, I don't know how they'll take this, but, you know, I don't feel comfortable with the investigators' focus on Bob Crane. I don't feel comfortable with the investigators' focus, with the police focus on John Carpenter as the sole suspect, not only in 1978, but also in 1992 when they had arrested him for the murder.
So the focus is on John Henry Carpenter, and maybe we'll untangle that a little bit more. But first, maybe we should discuss how Bob Crane is found in June 1978 and the crime scene itself.
Well, Bob, as I mentioned, was in a play called Beginner's Luck, and it was a romantic comedy, and he had been in Scottsdale. He'd been in Scottsdale for more than a few days, I think for a couple of weeks at least. And he was part of, and he was on tour with the play. The play was being performed at the Windmill Theater. And as part of his deal with the Windmill, they would put their stars of the play and the actors up in apartments. And he was staying in apartment 132A at a place called the Winfield Apartments. Now, he was found at his apartment at the Winfield in June 29th of 1978. And he was found in his bed, what appeared to be a fetal position, with his hands next to his head, or close to his face. And Bob was covered in blood. His head had been caved in twice, at least. It had been hit twice. So there was blunt force trauma to Bob's head. He was hit at least in the left side of his head, the left temple. And so you have somebody in bed, in this fetal position, and it looked as if he was in a deep sleep. It did not look like he had got up. There certainly didn't seem to be any struggle. It looked as if he was killed where he slept, in bed. And now, the problem, of course, initially was that he's covered in blood because he's been struck by a heavy object. So this death was a bludgeoning death. And my understanding in regards to the area, not just Phoenix, not just Scottsdale, Arizona, but Phoenix as well, which is a bigger city, they didn't get deaths like this. So this was very unusual. Now, on the bed itself was, I believe, a large black bag. This bag was completely empty. I think there were actually some papers in the bag, papers inside, but this bag was empty. Now, when people talk about this crime in regards to documentaries or on TV, one of the things I don't see discussed is this black bag that Bob used to carry with him. Not only did he carry, you know, all his video equipment from town to town, as well as his own clothing in a suitcase, he had this black bag, and this is what he normally put his photo albums in. And these photo albums, or this photo album, normally it was a standard photo album about 6 by 12, This photo album had Polaroids of women in usually naked, maybe some were clothes, but normally nude women, and perhaps women performing sexual acts, either with him or someone else, I guess. But this photo album is where he kept his pictures and his Polaroids. And it was kept in this black bag. Now, this black bag, as I mentioned, was empty. Now, here's what's interesting. This black bag also had other items in it. The weird part is that Bob wouldn't let people anywhere near that bag, from what I understand. He usually kept it out of sight. And one of the things that I'm curious about is why this isn't talked about that much when we hear the death of Bob Crane. I don't hear too many people mentioning this black bag, which was on the bed itself. I think you also had some wadded up underwear, wadded up a pair of shorts or something. But you had this black bag, which was on the bed, open. The papers inside, but it was empty. My view is, in regards to this case, that either the murderer of Bob Crane or someone else who was there took all the contents of that bag. And there was a reason they took the contents of that bag. They were important. Bob had contents there that were significant and were perhaps damaging. Who to, I don't know. So one of the things that I would say in regards to this case is, and I don't even know if it's possible now because this murder case is more than 30 years old, I believe the only way that you can solve this case is to find out not only what was in that black bag, but besides the photo album, but who might have taken the bag and for what reason. I think if you find out what was in the bag, I don't know how that would happen, but if you find out what was in that bag, and if by some rare feat you can find out what was in the bag, I doubt that, you'll be able to find out who may have killed Bob Crane.
Well, you know, as you said, the Scottsdale Police Department was not really well-equipped to deal with this. I'm pretty sure that I read they didn't even have, like, a full homicide department at the time of the murder.
No, they didn't. They had detectives that covered various crimes, but they didn't have a homicide squad or a division. They basically had some detectives that could cover different crimes like, you know, thefts and assaults, probably. There was no homicide bureau. There was no homicide squad. And so for the most part, you didn't get a lot of murders in Scottsdale. I think maybe they had a handful of murders every year there. So they were severely, not so much understaffed or resource poor as a small city police department that didn't handle crimes like this. First of all, as I mentioned before, this was a bludgeoning death. This was a death that involved a good deal of blood volume, because you had the blood that had pooled around and on Bob Crane's face and head. And you also had blood on the walls near his bed. And some blood had gotten on a date book, which was on a dresser or nightstand right next to the bed, which is where he also had his glasses and a pen. So you're talking about a very violent death. You're also talking about a murder in general and the murder of a celebrity. So you're talking about three strikes against this police department because they probably didn't get anything like this normally in regards to their municipality. This was a rare occurrence for them. And so to be brutally honest, although I'm critical of what happened in regards to their handling of the crime scene and what happened in regards to murder, I'm also sympathetic to the fact that they weren't really equipped and they weren't really, didn't really have the resources to handle this kind of crime. And I understand that, and I'm a little sympathetic to that. But still, I mean, the mistakes that were made in this case, it's no wonder that it's an unsolved mystery.
Now, as we said, John Carpenter quickly becomes the prime suspect in this investigation. I believe early on, even before the trial in the 90s, correct?
Yeah, well, for one thing, I will say that John was making moves that I thought were kind of odd. For example, he called the apartment after he got back to LA. He called the apartment, meaning the Winfield apartment where Bob's body was found and where he had stayed prior to his death. He called the apartment and the police talked to John during this call. And one of the things that the police noted after John hung up was he didn't seem fazed by the fact that police were there at the apartment. So that was suspicious to them. So he attracted suspicion from the very beginning. John had also called, I think, Bob Crane Jr., one of Bob's sons, with his wife Anne, and called him and they had a brief conversation. And Bob Crane Jr. was wondering, well, why is he calling me? That seems odd. And I think he had called around. I think he had called the Windmill Theater. He had called he called around by the time he had already gotten back to LA. So that was one of the first instances where I think the police were a little suspicious of John. And to be honest, it wasn't a smart move on his part.
And I guess the theory is that Crane was bludgeoned by one of these camera tripods that John and Bob would have used to film their sexual encounters.
Well, at first the police didn't know what the murder weapon was because they never found a murder weapon. They found Bob's body, but they did not find a murder weapon. So the supposition and the educated guess was that it was a tripod. In fact, I believe they had initially thought it was a tire iron or some other kind of hard metallic object. And I think someone had floated the idea that it may have been a tripod. And I think they took a tripod of the type that Bob had for his video camera, which was at the apartment there. They took a similar tripod and I think matched it up against, I know they matched it up against the bedspread because there were two blood marks, like somebody had wiped off something. And they matched up against the bedspread and it was an exact match. They also, I believe, matched up against I don't know if it was Bob's exact head, but they matched it up, I think, near some replica or some aspect of Bob's corpse. They matched it up, and it also was seen similar to what had hit Bob. So their assumption and their educated opinion was that it was a tripod, a camera tripod. We don't know that it was a camera tripod. The assumption is that it was. The educated opinion is that it was. And that's interesting because that aspect to me gets into what was going on in this case and how Bob was murdered. Because my theory or my view of Bob's murder isn't the ones normally expressed by people who've looked into the case.
Well, I mean, that sounds pretty juicy. Maybe you could elaborate a little bit?
Okay. Here's my view of the Bob Crane murder. As we had mentioned before, the belief is that on the part of the police and upon other people, that John Carpenter is the prime suspect and that John Carpenter was the murderer of Bob Crane. Why this is the case? Because John was being given the shaft. he was being basically jilted by Bob. Not romantically jilted, because they weren't involved, but jilted in terms of friendships. Friendships are relationships like romantic relationships in many respects. You know, friendships break up just like boyfriends and girlfriends break up. And according to Bob Crane Jr., his father had told him that he was looking to put distance between him and John, that they weren't going to be friends anymore. He wanted to end that friendship.
He claims that Bob referred to John as having become a nuisance, basically.
Yes, he was a hanger-on. And if you look at the relationship, you know, the fact of the matter was that they were guys who were, like I said, from that sexual component, from that friendship component, in regards to chasing the ladies or chasing women, it was a pilot-co-pilot relationship, right? So once you end that relationship, the belief was it would make it harder for John Carpenter to go after the ladies, because he wouldn't have Bob Crane to help him get laid. Wouldn't have Bob Crane to tell women, hey, you know, he's really my manager. You know, should talk to him. He wouldn't have that. So, and the other component of that, as we were mentioning before, was the fact that the belief was that John Carpenter was bisexual, and that there was a sexual component on John's part toward Bob. And I've addressed this previously, but I will say again that I don't believe that this component was valid, because it sort of puts out there the belief and the notion that just because they weren't going to be friends anymore, that somehow John couldn't take that and he had to kill Bob. And I don't really buy that. You know, in my experience as a guy, guys don't get violent with other guys because they're not friends anymore. That isn't how it works. Women's friendships are often very emotional and very deep. So it's a very strong bond that's there. It's not that men don't have strong relationships with other men in terms of friendships, but it isn't to that extent that men would kill other men because they're not friends anymore. And some people would hear what I'm saying and go, well, I think you're being stereotypical, that you're being sort of, you're dealing in archetypes, you're kind of being sort of rigid in your thinking. No, I don't buy that John's reason for supposedly being the murderer of Bob Crane is that they weren't going to be friends anymore. Or that he wouldn't be friends with Bob and thus wouldn't be able to get laid as much as he would like, so therefore he had to kill him. That strikes me as ridiculous.
Well, not only that, but, I mean, we can ask questions like cui bono, right? But a lot of the evidence against John Henry Carpenter, as far as I can tell, is pretty much extremely circumstantial.
Right. I would agree. It's what I would call a case of convenience or a convenience case in regards to the law. It's convenient to label him as and see him as the prime suspect and the only suspect and the murderer because he was in Scottsdale. So he's in the geographic area. He was staying at the Sunburst Hotel, which was a couple of blocks from the Winfield Apartments. So he was nearby. He knew Bob. They were friends. It's logical to could have been the murderer of Bob Crane. It's not illogical. The problem is there's never been any definitive evidence that points to John. There never was. This is one of the reasons I don't believe John should have been put on trial in 1994. That case was a waste of time because the evidence really wasn't there. It wasn't there.
And he wasn't found guilty.
No. And the jury, I think they had interviewed in a documentary called Murder in Scottsdale, which can be found in the special features section of the movie Autofocus. It's also on YouTube. You can look it up on YouTube if you want. one of the jury foremen says the DNA was a key factor. If they had definitive DNA that established, because DNA was very new at the time, 1994 is when the trial took place. If they had definitive DNA that proved that Bob Crane's blood was in John Carpenter's rental car, that jury member says they would have convicted John Carpenter.
I was just going to add real quick, that brings up another point. Yeah. You know, the Phoenix-based anchorman, John Hook, recently wrote a book called Who Killed Bob Crane, and he was looking into DNA evidence with regards to this rental car of John Carpenter's, and it came back that, you know, the blood on that car was not Bob Crane.
That doesn't surprise me at all. I was always suspicious about the blood evidence in this case. Very suspicious. It just never made any sense to me. The amount was minuscule. In fact, I believe the county attorney at the time, I think his name is Hyder, Charles Hyder, I believe his name was, he didn't want to put forward a warrant for Carpenter and proceed on a case. And the major reason that he cited was at least that there wasn't enough evidence and that they had focused on John Carpenter. And what the police detectives in the case, I believe Ron Dean and Dennis Borkenhagen with the Scottsdale Police Department, what they were told was, that you need, that you have to have murder weapon with fingerprints or a confession. And there clearly wasn't either. There's no confession, and there's no murder weapon or fingerprints on a murder weapon. There were fingerprints all over the apartment, but no fingerprints on a murder weapon because no murder weapon was found. Whoever or whomever the murderer was, brought the murder weapon with them, and took the murder weapon out with them. That's very clear. They or someone else also took what was in the black bag. I keep coming to the black bag because I never hear this bag discussed in this case. Nobody discusses it. I never hear anything about it, which is odd to me. There are other aspects, but this is odd. This bag was actually on the bed itself. Now, if you've seen the movie Autofocus, you won't see a black bag on that bed. But then again, the movie Autofocus wasn't meant to be an accurate biopic that looked solely at the death of Bob Crane. So you can kind of excuse them for not focusing on his death. It was about his life, and I understand that. Still, I mean, if you're going to render the death scene and you're going to deal with the crime scene, you should have all the details that you need there. And that black bag was on the bed. So whoever killed Bob, or whomever killed Bob, not only brought the murder weapon with them, but likely took something out of the apartment. Because photo album was gone, and there were pictures that were missing, because Bob had pictures in the bathroom. He had a photo enlarger and photos that were in this enlarger that I guess he was blowing up. There were videotapes, I believe, that had been taken. So there were clearly items that were missing in that apartment. The black bag, to me, is the major one. And so from my viewpoint, and looking at this, looking at the case and looking at some of the photos of the blood and other remains or items that they had found. I'm looking at this and I'm going, and the blood itself has always been suspicious to me. The blood itself has been suspicious. It's just a tiny amount. It's in a sort of thin, stringy line, almost, not quite straight line, but a spin stringy line on the car door, which was a white car that John had rented. There was also blood on the door jamb of the car. And I'm going, and we're dealing with a bludgeoning death. Now keep in mind, whoever killed Bob blood had to have hit them. I would be surprised if there was absolutely no blood that they got on them, because they had to be close enough to Bob to smash his skull, to hit him with enough force to kill him. So they had to have gotten blood on them, in my view. I would be surprised if they didn't. So the blood evidence to me has always been suspicious to me in regards to Carpenter's car, among other things.
Well, I was going to say, do we really have much to go on? I mean, I guess we know from certain witnesses, I believe Carolyn Bear, that Crane basically spent his last nights drinking and partying. I believe Carolyn Bear was maybe the last person to have seen Bob alive. But
that's
really
my understanding.
We really don't have much to go on outside of that.
No. That's why I said this case should never, never have gone to trial in 1994. And because there's so many holes you could poke into this story.
Well, it's even weird that they would, you know, try Carpenter so many years after it happened.
Well, you have to look at what was going on in the city at the time. The county attorney, the attorney at the time, what would be district attorney's office elsewhere, they said, look, you don't have enough evidence to make a case against Carpenter. And they were right. I can't disagree with the decision that was made. You have to understand, with prosecutors, they want sure things. They don't want half-ass cases. They don't want cases that are going to blow up in their faces. They want cases that are going to lead to surefire convictions. And if they don't get those convictions, they're not going to take the case. It's what I call need or plead. You need the evidence in order to make a conviction, or we'll plead out and get a deal. So that's what they want. You know, if they can't get evidence to go to trial, they're not going to do it. That's true of any prosecutor anywhere, I think. But in this case, these guys, the Hyder, just seem to look at the case and go, you don't have it. Now, people can criticize him all they want and say that he was wrong to do that, but I think he was, I think he saw what I saw, which was that there was very little evidence that Carpenter committed this crime, if indeed he was the main suspect in this case. It just wasn't there. Is Carpenter a logical suspect? Absolutely. Is he a feasible suspect? No question. But is he the only person you look at in this case? No. It's ridiculous that they focused on him. It was just, again, a case of convenience, or what I call a convenience case, not to mention a circumstantial case.
Well, you know, I guess setting aside John Henry Carpenter, as we begin to wrap up here, you know, Bob's son, Robert, has said there's only two people he ever thought of as being capable of this crime, and that's John Henry Carpenter, who Robert Crane Jr. now says, you know, I don't think it was him due to this new DNA evidence. The only other person that Robert Crane Jr. thinks could have been a suspect is Patricia Olson, and that may be because Robert Crane Jr., as well as Bob's other family members, they didn't receive any of the estate after Bob Crane passed away. That was all given to Patty Olson. Do you think she's a feasible suspect in this, or would you discard that as well?
She's a feasible suspect, and I believe that Bob Crane Jr. is right to be suspicious of his stepmother. I know that she, from what I understand, she had come to Scottsdale with her son, Scotty, their son, really, and had visited Bob. And they had a rather tense day together or something like that. It was not a pleasant day. They had a very difficult relationship. It was a very bitter divorce. Very bitter divorce. And I believe that their arguments and their squabbles were sometimes violent. You know, Bob wasn't a guy who hit people, but she, Patty, hit Bob, from what I understand, threw stuff at him. So there was violence, there was volatility in that relationship. So she's a feasible suspect. There's no doubt about that. The question is whether she was there precisely on that date. He was found on June 29th, Thursday, June 29th. So according to the medical examiner, Dr. Karnitsky, Crane was probably murdered in the early morning hours. So because he was discovered by an actress in Beginner's Luck named Victoria Berry, and she had come in. She was supposed to meet with Bob, I believe, at 2:00 in the afternoon. And I believe it come earlier than arranged, and strangely enough had knocked twice and then tried the doorknob, and the door was open, and went in and called out for Bob, ostensibly, from what she says occurred, and then went near the bedroom and saw there was a figure on the bed, someone on the bed. I think at first she thought it was a woman. And then she got close enough because there was all this blood on Bob, and he was covered in blood. His face and head were covered in blood, and there was blood on the wall. And I think at first she thought it was a woman. I think Bob, from what I understand, had mentioned to her that he had dated a woman or had been with a woman who had cut her wrist or something years ago. But she looked at this body. She was looking at it and focusing on it, who could this be? And she saw the watch, I believe, that Bob was wearing, which is a rather expensive one. And she looked at this, and it was then she realized that Bob was on the bed and that he was dead, and I guess she hightailed it out of there. Strangely enough, after the police had come, that's a whole other matter. I mean, to be brutally honest, the police handling at first, the crime scene was compromised because you had police that were smoking in that apartment. Victoria herself was allowed to come back in where she was, I think, writing out a statement or something along that line because she ended up taking a phone call from Bob Crane Jr. Bob had called the apartment and she answered it or was allowed to answer it. And was wondering about her dad, he was wondering about his dad, and she said his father wasn't there, which wasn't true. His father had already died. And Bob Crane Jr. had to find out about it later on. He didn't find out at the time because they didn't tell him. Victoria certainly didn't. But Victoria was in that apartment. You had cops that were smoking. In fact, I believe a cop had left some cigarettes there. And so you had cops touching stuff. You had all kinds of things that shouldn't have been there. When you have a crime scene, you have to be very careful. I believe it was the father of forensics who said, every contact leaves a trace. Once you're in a crime scene, anything you do as a person there at that crime scene may have an impact on that crime scene. It may dilute it. It may devastate evidence that's there, not only fingerprint evidence, if you touch something, but also, or wipe down something, or even place something down, it could ruin crime scenes. And I believe that crime scene was ruined, not only by cops going in, walking around and smoking, but also Victoria smoking. You know, if that had happened today, there's no way that would have been allowed to happen, I don't think, even a place like Scottsdale.
You know, from the way you're describing it, it almost sounds like a dark twist on the old incompetent, humorous Keystone Cops scenario.
Mm. Well, like I said, this was a police department that didn't get very many murders in their jurisdiction. So they didn't have a homicide division. They didn't have a homicide squad. And they didn't have a murder of this magnitude. And as I mentioned before, they didn't get bludgeonings. You know, so they, I think they just didn't really know how to handle this.
So in a way, you can't really blame them. Yeah.
Well, I blame them from a professional standpoint of the way things were conducted, but I understand. I have an understanding. You know, I have a slight bit of sympathy. But I have to call, you know, as Howard Cosell used to say, you have to call it like it is. And I have to call it like it is. I think they did a poor job in regards to the crime scene here. And this has clearly had an impact. How much of an impact, I can't say, but it clearly had an impact in regards to this case. So you have a compromised crime scene to begin with. You have an extremely bloody and brutal crime also. I mean, you have two strikes against you right there.
Well, you know, it's been, what, 40 years now, and this case is still a cold one. Do you think it's going to remain that way?
It will remain that way until something dramatic happens. And I would say at this point, now, I noted how my view in regards to John Carpenter is different than other people. I'm just going to come out and lay out my view of this case and what I think happened here and what I think is behind the case and who may have killed Crane. Maybe not necessarily solve it. I'm not looking to solve this case, but I am looking to put a sort of construct, deal with this case in terms of providing a construct that people can look at now instead of looking at the same old song and dance that they've been fed year in and year out. There's been no out-of-the-box thinking in regards to this case. And so what I'm offering is out-of-the-box thinking. So in regards to this case, let me just state from the beginning, as I mentioned before, could John Carpenter have killed Bob Crane? The answer clearly is yes. Did he have the opportunity to do so? The answer clearly is yes. Did he do so? I believe he didn't. I believe John, however, I do believe John was in the apartment the night that Bob was killed. And when I say that, I mean, I believe he was there, probably after Bob was killed. It's very clear to me that John knew that Bob had been murdered. It's very clear to me. That explains his unease. That explains his nervousness. It explains why he was looking to get out of his hotel and get to the airport, you know, and he turned in the rental car and said, hey, take this off the lot. You know, I've had all these problems. It's why he was very anxious to get away from Scottsdale and get his flight and get to California because he knew Bob was dead. He had been in the apartment. He saw his body. It was very clear that he knew Bob was dead.
But then why not report it to the police?
Here's the thing. I believe that the reason, well, let's be fair to John. John did try to cooperate with the police because he was questioned by the police in 1978, and he was questioned, of course, later in 92 when he was arrested. So he did cooperate with the police. It's not like he, you know, he said, look, leave me alone. I don't want anything to do with you. I won't say anything about the case. I won't have anything to do with it. He was cooperative with the police. And again, as I mentioned before, I think he was acting suspiciously and he was doing things that attracted attention to him. And I believe that was because he was in the apartment and he knew that Bob had been murdered. He knew that Bob had been murdered. I think part of the reason that he didn't, that he wasn't as forthcoming, even though he worked with the police in terms of being questioned, was because John knew certain things about maybe not so much Bob's death, but about Bob. See, my view of Bob Crane is not, is that I believe he was killed not over a ruptured friendship or because of a relationship between John Carpenter. I believe he was killed because of what he knew. I believe that he was aware of certain things, certain factors. What makes me suspicious about the death of Bob Crane is the fact that his black bag was empty. And Bob didn't allow anyone near that bag other than himself, from what I understand, and from what I've read, and what I've researched in this case. He had that bag for a reason. There were items in it that he considered important. What those items were, I cannot say. But he considered them important. And we know that John and Bob had their sexcapades, that they were into not only picking up women, but other aspects of sexuality. I think Bob had a knowledge probably relating to certain goings-on in terms of maybe Los Angeles, maybe the film industry, I don't know. And I think that Bob was killed ultimately because of what he was aware of and what he knew. I think that's why Bob was killed. I think it was his knowledge that ultimately led to his death.
Knowledge in particular of what? I don't want to be subtle about it necessarily. I want to sort of dig into what you mean by that.
Right. Well, okay.
I know we're speculating here, by the way, too, but
right. Well, I'm offering my point of view and my theory of his death. Yeah. So I am speculating, but I'm also speculating and making a theory based upon the evidence that I see and also the details of the case. So that's clear. Now, here's something that isn't really talked about that much in regards to this case. In 1992, before he was arrested for the murder of Bob Crane, John Carpenter was arrested in L.A., and he was arrested for having sex with minors.
That's a dramatic pause there, folks. Go on.
Right. Yeah. So he was arrested for having sex with a minor. I think this was a bit of a surprise to cops that worked the case and to others. But supposedly he had pleaded no contest to having sexual relations between, I think it was a teenager, at least a teenager. With a couple of young ladies, from what I understand. And I think he pleaded no contest. And I bring this up because it sort of gets into what I believe that I think Crane may have been aware of. I think that Crane was aware of certain things going on in regards to, how do I put this? In terms of what people probably in the industry were into.
You mean sexually, of course. Yeah.
Right. I believe that, you know, because he was involved in such things as swinging and he was into pornography, he was not only filming his own pornography, but he was into pornography, that he was aware of certain aspects in Los Angeles and in and around the industry and other aspects. And I believe it was what was going on of this nature that pretty much led to his death.
Well, I, you know, thinking about it now, I can sort of see where you're coming from on that, because, you know, Hollywood has long been a place of, you know, sexual scandals going back to, you know, the 1920s, right? With, you know, a character like Fatty Arbuckle, and I mean, even today, with you know, Harvey Weinstein, you know, there's even a Hollywood aspect to the you know, ongoing Jeffrey Epstein case. And,
right.
You know, you have a lot of seedy sort of criminal elements that have worked in Hollywood too. Someone like Sidney Korshak, the sort of mob, how do I put it? He was connected to the mob and also connected to Hollywood at the same time. So there's always been these really seedy aspects of Hollywood that I think haven't always been uncovered.
Right, right. That's precisely correct. I get the feeling that in his circles, in the, you know, the circles that he was moving around outside of, you know, his work in film and TV, and in his sort of sexual life, and in his sexual, sort of in the sexual underworld, so to speak, and in those proclivities, and in those circles, that Crane was aware of certain things that were going on that may have involved people within the film and TV industry, but I think involved other people as well. And I get the feeling that Bob was aware of certain things. Now, again, he's an actor. He's not a journalist. He's not a writer. But what struck me when I read about Carpenter being arrested for that charge in 92 was, and pleading no contest, was that something else was really going on in their relationship. And I think part of the reason that those two were on the outs is that they both were aware of certain things, and Bob probably just couldn't handle it. You know, I think he got to a point where he was tired of not so much his lifestyle, but or the fact that he liked, you know, having sex with lots of women. But I think there were aspects not only of his lifestyle, but also what he was aware of in his lifestyle that he was not happy with and didn't like. And I think those two were aware of things that were going on, in my view. And I believe that's the reason why he was killed. I think that's why Bob was killed. It was what he knew. It wasn't who he was or who John was. I don't think it was a severed relationship in that sense. I really think that something else was going on.
It's certainly interesting in light of a lot of the things we know about Hollywood. I was unaware that Carpenter pled no contest in a case that involved teenagers. But I mean, you know, with stuff like, the child actors like Corey Haim or Corey Haim from The Lost Boys, a lot is coming out about that. Corey Feldman is now saying things about, you know, sort of how teenagers have been sexually treated in Hollywood. So that's coming out more and more. There was even a documentary about it, An Open Secret. I don't know how far that goes, if it's as conspiratorial as some people want to make out. It's all very murky waters. But is that sort of what you're saying Bob Crane may have been onto, or?
I think he may have been aware of some of that. I think he may have been aware of some of that. Because what took me off was the fact that Carpenter was arrested in June of 1992 and brought before court in L.A. on about three counts of lewd conduct involving a minor. And he was supposedly had, I will call it, indecent conduct with a 12-year-old and a 10-year-old. And
that's extremely young. That's extremely young.
Yes. Right. And so that got me thinking. I said, because I'm trying to remember when I was doing the research for this, and I did the research for this podcast, I looked at that and I went, there's something about that that sort of got me thinking. And I said, it makes it all the more interesting that Carpenter is the main suspect in this case. Because, like I said, I believe they both knew things. They both did. And when I look at the evidence in this case, and I look at how things were, there's an arrow that's pointing at John Carpenter. But there's not an arrow that's pointing at other people in this case. We know, for example, that Victoria Berry, who discovered Bob Crane's body, she had a key that she was given by Bob to his apartment, because Bob had taken not only his key, there were three keys for the apartment at the Winfield Apartments that were normally given, that was normally where the star of any show was put up. So he got a key, his own key for the apartment. There was a key in the theater, and there was a key, I think, with the owner or director of the theater. And so if we look at Victoria Berry, who had discovered Bob Crane's body, she was given a key by Bob. I think it was a blue key. There were three keys to Bob's apartment, which was the apartment of the star of the show. And Bob had a key. The theater had a key, which he also took for some reason. And the owner and director of the theater also had a key. So there were three keys to that apartment. Bob had taken two keys. He had given a key to Victoria Berry. So she had a key to the apartment. And we know, in looking at the case, that there was no forced entry. So nobody broke in. Whoever went into the apartment either had to have a key, or they had to have been let in. Someone inside the apartment let them in, or they had a key and came in. If I look at the condition that Bob was in the apartment, he was in what appeared to be sort of a deep REM sleep cycle. My understanding is that he was a light sleeper from what I've read, which meant the slightest noise or rustle would get him up. So it was very clear that whoever killed Bob, he was comfortable enough to be in bed sleeping. This lends me to believe that whoever killed Bob was most likely female. I don't rule out that a man could have killed him. I believe the medical examiner Karnischke had said that it was likely a man because of the way that the blows were administered, in terms of the arcs of taking his heavy object and striking it on Bob's head. I tend to believe that the killer may have been female, because there was a cord around Bob's neck that was found when he was found. So whoever killed Bob also took a cord from a VCR, cut it, and wrapped it around his neck. Now, notice earlier that I had said that there's an arrow pointing in the direction of John Carpenter. I think whoever killed Bob Crane wanted John Carpenter to be considered the suspect. It's very clear to me. Now, as I mentioned before, John was in that apartment. He knew Bob was killed. In my view, when he got there and he saw what had happened, I think John took out that black bag, grabbed all those contents, and tried to get out. Now, there were some movers out there at about 4 a.m. in the morning. And my understanding is they saw a guy leaving the apartment that, I guess, basically seemed like John. I think they also said that a woman had come out of the apartment screaming prior to that. But someone who looked vaguely like John, answered to his description, got into a white car and drove off. As I mentioned, I believe John was in the apartment on the night of the murder. He knew that Bob had been killed. I believe if he didn't kill Bob, and I believe that's a strong possibility that he did not kill him, that he took that black bag, took those contents, and when he got the chance, hightailed it out of it. I believe that the killer was probably female, though I believe also that there was a man and a woman in the apartment I don't believe that a man necessarily killed Bob simply because he was in bed, he was sleeping, and I don't think he would have allowed himself to be in that position with a guy around, even somebody like John Carpenter. I just don't see that happening. It just doesn't seem logical to me, based upon what we know of his, the way he carried on. When you deal with a murder victim, and when you deal with people who've died, you have to look at two major factors, their habits and their behavior. Because their habits and their behavior help determine why they were killed and who might have killed them. We know that Bob was a teetotaler and generally didn't drink, yet there were bottles of alcohol there in the apartment. I think there was scotch and there was gin. Why? If Bob bought them, who did he buy them for? We know that Bob was scheduled to see Victoria Berry the next day, about 2 p.m. in the afternoon. What that was about, not sure. I know that Bob had taped some rehearsals or some sessions of the play Beginner's Luck with Victoria, and they were trying to fix the sound, I guess, on the tape. And for me, Victoria discovering Bob's body is very suspicious because Bob always locked the apartment after a female had left or a guy had left or anyone had left. He always locked it. I believe he had a place in Chicago that was broken into, and it always made him very, very careful. So he always locked the apartment after people had left, and he would unlock it to let them in. Victoria is the person who discovers him. She knocks, according to her story, she knocks twice on the door and then tries the doorknob. My point is, if she knew Bob's habits well enough, being a co-star and having been in an apartment, why would she try the doorknob? Wouldn't she know that the apartment was locked? Wouldn't she know Bob's habit? So she finds it's open. She goes in. She says she looks at him and then finally makes the identification and then leaves screaming. Gets someone, I believe the woman's name was Mary Lou Hawkins, to go call the police. Like I said, her story is suspicious to me. So at this point, I'm convinced whoever killed Bob Crane was more than likely female, judging from the fact he was in bed and undisturbed and sleeping. And I believe that John was in the apartment that night, and he may have taken what was in that black bag. And if John didn't, he was still there in that apartment that night and knew what was going on, knew that Bob had been killed, and tried to hightail it out of there. So I don't think that John is entirely innocent from the standpoint of the murder. I think that he was there and he knew what was going on. And I think that was why he was suspicious.
Now, you mentioned Victoria Berry, though. You don't think she's so innocent either?
I don't. I think there's something suspicious about her. Yeah. I mean, I don't entirely buy her story. And I think Stephen Avila, who had been the attorney for John Carpenter, I don't think he did either. And I think he was right to. But my contention in this case is whoever killed Bob Crane was female, for the most part. Now, could a man have done it? Very clearly. But if this occurred, the only way that would have occurred is if a woman was also in the apartment. I don't believe that a man came into that apartment, struck Bob Crane two times, took the bag, got the contents out, got whatever else, videotapes and other pictures around the apartment, and then headed out. I believe that I think there was more than one person in that apartment. I believe it was more than one person. I believe his killer was female. That's what I believe. And I believe the killing was done in such a way as to make John Carpenter look like the guilty party. It's very clear to me. Now, I'm sure there are people who will disagree with me. I'm sure the police in Scottsdale, Arizona, will say, hey, I think you're way off there. We think it's John Carpenter, and they'll point to this, that, and the other thing. Well, how can you focus on one guy when you have a person like Crane who had shot numerous women on his, what I call, love tapes, numerous women on having sexual acts on video? And you could have had multiple suspects. There could have been numerous suspects, but they just focused on John Carpenter because I think it was easy. I think it was convenient for them to do so, a case of convenience. You know, In a sense, I don't blame them for doing so, but you need to do so after reducing and eliminating all the known suspects and all the possible suspects. I don't see that in this case. It just seemed like, hey, he's the guy. And we're convinced. Well, maybe do some more detective work. Maybe do some more investigating. You know, maybe you shouldn't have screwed up the crime scene too.
Well, I want to note. It didn't click until just now. But Victoria Ann Barry wasn't just some stage actress either. In Arizona, she was also, you know, making her way around Hollywood. She ended up being in the Cheech and Chong movies.
Hmm.
So she was trying to make a career in Hollywood as well, so she would have been involved in Hollywood circles, yeah.
Right. Like I said, this case is very suspicious to me. I'm convinced that Bob was not killed because of a severed friendship. I don't believe it was that way. The motive for John Carpenter just doesn't seem to be there. Oh, they weren't friends anymore. He wouldn't get laid because he wasn't around Bob. I don't buy it. I just don't.
Well, there's one more thing I wanted to add real quick. When we were talking about the motive, the whole idea of, you know, maybe Bob knew something about sexual goings on in Hollywood, and it just clicked in my mind just now that there would have been a lot of heat on Hollywood at that time, because June 1978 is not that far removed from March 1977 when, you know, the Roman Polanski scandal hits Roman Polanski and the 13-year-old girl. So, you know,
right.
I'm not saying this has anything to do with Polanski, but I'm saying there was probably more scrutiny on a lot of Hollywood figures at the time due to that scandal. So maybe someone like Crane did know things going on in Hollywood that, you know, would have had people concerned in light of scandals like Polanski.
Right. That's interesting you bring up Roman Polanski. I don't associate him with this murder, but it's interesting in terms of the historical context.
No, I'm not associating him, but...
Right. But the historical context is interesting. It's interesting. Again, when I look at this case, you know, having researched, having looked into this and read about it and so forth, I've come to a different conclusion that other people have, and I thought outside the box. And I think there are things that are going on because of Crane's interest in pornography, his making of pornography himself, with himself and John Crane, John Carpenter and others, with his interest in sex and making it and getting as much sex as possible, and the sort of demi-monde or underworld in regards to different aspects of sexuality, like swinging and other types of practices and interests. It was very clear to me that it became clear to me that this was just more than some kind of limited, sordid murder. I think that he was killed because of what he realized and what he may have been aware of. And I think that he was someone who, for whatever reason, couldn't be left alive. That's what I think. I mean, I think it really was what he was aware of and what he was, what he knew. And I think the same was true with John Carpenter.
Well, I mean, yeah, even with the sort of pornography angle, I mean, people forget now, but I mean, back then, organized crime was the main source for the production of pornography. So,
right.
You know,
they funded pornography. It was largely funded through organized crime families. For example, one production company, I believe Bryanston Films, had which had done the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
They did. They ended up doing Deep Throat, and then they did Texas Chainsaw Massacre to say, "Oh, we're a legit film company," and to sort of get the FBI off their track. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the porn industry, like any other industry, had to be capitalized. It had to be funded. So it was funded in many respects through through the mafia because they had the financial means to do so. And they had the capital to do so. I mean, you can't go to a bank and get money to start a, you know, to start a club that will show 8 millimeter, 16 millimeter loops, or to start a porn theater. No, that's got to come from some other source, more than likely. And especially in regards to porn productions, those were often financed years ago by mob-oriented companies. Like I said, Bryanston Films was one.
Well, yeah, I mean, you had a lot of just, I mean, to put it simply, you had a lot of mob involvement in the entertainment industry. I remember the book Dark Victory by Dan Moldea, really great journalist, deals with that
yes.
topic. Yeah. The MCA and all kinds of groups. There was
right.
so many fingers in the pie when it came to organized crime.
Well, hate to get a little off track, but Moldea is the guy who had written about the NFL essentially being tethered to gambling. And he had noted that the NFL games, I believe, were fixed. They were rigged in some respects. And so just saying that is a bit of an aside there. But, yeah. See, it's interesting where this is kind of going. And, I mean, this case has kind of allowed me to kind of think outside the parameters that have been established. Something about the fact that Carpenter was seen as the main suspect never quite jived with me. It never quite fit. I never thought that Carpenter was an innocent party in the sense that he wasn't aware of what was going on or that he didn't know things. I believe that he wasn't entirely innocent. But at the same time, there's something about the death of Crane that makes me all the more convinced that Carpenter could not have solely been the murderer of Crane. I just don't think that he was the guy who did the crime. Not that he couldn't have done it, but none of what we saw there made any sense. Everything to me seems to point in a direction of trying to stage it so as to make him the prime suspect and the major suspect. That cord around the neck made no sense to me. Carpenter, I don't know a whole heck of a lot about, but what little I know about, he doesn't strike me as a man who would do something like that. That seems like a detail that would be done by somebody who wants to give you the notion that this person committed the crime. After all, it came from a VCR. What did Carpenter do? Help set up VCRs for celebrities at one point. Yeah, There's something about this case that really stinks. It really smells.
Do you think that could have also been sending a message to Carpenter?
I think so. I think that was clearly a message. I think it was. Yeah. I think they wanted, if they couldn't get him out of the way, then they wanted him to bear the brunt of the scrutiny, which he did. He did. You know, he was seen as the prime suspect by the police in Scottsdale. He's been seen as the prime suspect by people who have looked at this case. Every time you talk about the Bob Crane murder, John Carpenter is always front and center. Even in the book by Robert Graysmith, The Murder of Bob Crane, I believe Graysmith basically thinks that Carpenter, I don't know if he comes out and says this, but I think he views him largely as the guy who may have killed Crane. And I think one of the reasons he does that is Graysmith says that the car that Bob was driving, there was a flat tire. And they went to a gas station to get another tire to get it fixed. And the guy at the gas station noticed the valve cord of the tire was tampered with. And he thought somebody had done that deliberately. They wanted him stranded there. And, you know, that's an interesting point. And I think Graysmith's inference is that this was what Carpenter was trying to do. He's trying to get Bob to be stranded there so he could kill him or something, murder him there. But and so I think the general belief is that Carpenter did it, and I'm departing from this belief and saying I don't really think he did it. And I think the basic condition that Bob was found in would mean, demonstrates to me that it couldn't have been a man outright. If it was, there was a woman there, because I don't believe he would have slept that soundly if a man was there. I really don't. Maybe that's sexist to say, and I'm not trying to be sexist, but I don't think he would have done that. I think there was a woman there. And I believe more than likely a woman killed Bob Crane, that it was female.
Well, I guess in closing, is there any sort of final thoughts you want to give in regards to this specific case of, you know, just Hollywood scandal and sort of Hollywood noir?
I think when I look at this case, I just look at how sad it is. I think Bob Crane generally was an okay guy. I think he was a person who generally treated people well. I never got the notion that Bob was some sort of really perverse, disgusting, sick individual. He was into pornography, yes. But plenty of people into pornography. He was a guy who did things that I thought were kind of not smart moves in filming women having sex with him. And I think he was a slight bit of a lech, a polite lech, but a lech. I mean, I think he used his celebrity to bed as many women as possible. Had he just had affairs with women and had he just slept with women, that would have been his life, and it would have been, as far as I'm concerned, his business as far as things go. But once he started taping people, I think that was a problem. Was it a problem that got him killed? Maybe. I think it may have contributed to his getting killed. I think it was part of what was going over the line in regards to his private life and his sexual life. Photography, I think, was close to the line, but I think filming women and filming other things, perhaps, was way over the line. And I think the sad thing about this case is just, I think Bob wasn't doing what he needed to sort of anchor himself in a good place. And I wish he had. You know, I look at this case and I'm kind of sad. It's sad because it's a person that you think I mean, I liked Hogan's Heroes when I was a kid, and this was the first celebrity murder that I heard of when I was a kid. And I always wondered why. Why was this man killed? And it sort of kind of, I didn't think about it, but I guess it stayed with me for a long time. And now that I've looked into it, and now that I've kind of read about and done research about it, you know, I really do believe it was not a matter of a friendship gone bad, but I really think it was about what Bob was aware of. I think he knew things maybe that he shouldn't have known, or things he probably didn't want to know. And it had to do with his sex life and his sexuality. But I think in the end, it's a really sad case. And I think you have to take the good with the bad and the sweet with the sour. I think, yes, we should remember the good things about Bob Crane and his role on Hogan's Heroes and his role on other shows. But we also have to look at the darker side of his life. We have to look at, you know, the fact that he couldn't really contain his sexuality. And I think that ultimately led him on a path. I don't think his sexuality was the problem. I think his sexuality led him into other things that he became aware of, and that was the problem. And I think that basically led to his death.
Well, we've gone long on this episode of Parallax Views. I want to thank you, Albert Lanier, for going over this fascinating true crime case that really haunts Hollywood scandals. Albert, I want to give you a chance to plug your writing and let listeners know how they can read more of your work and keep up with you.
Well, I write a blog currently at medium.com, and so people can go to my blog at medium.com/@thedoctor50. I don't deal in Hollywood mysteries. I haven't written about this case specifically, the Bob Crane case. But, you know, it's one of the things personally I'm always interested in are mysteries and interesting news developments and historical development. So from a personal point, I found this case interesting. But normally with that blog, I deal with media and I deal with current events, ripped from the headlines news. So they can go to medium.com/@thedoctor50 to read my blog. And you can also contact me on Twitter. I'm at Critic Incorporated at Twitter. That's at Critic Incorporated at Twitter. And I'm also on Facebook. So if you have any theories or any ideas about, I guess, the Bob Crane case, hit me up on Twitter. And maybe I can see what you have in store.
Well, I want to add, too, you may not write about the Bob Crane case, right? Or necessarily Hollywood mysteries. But I do think what we're talking about also gives an insight into your writing, because your writing and your commentary, your analysis, it often provides a different take on things that is actually very well reasoned, but still provides sort of a refreshing take on matters related to current events and media, as you have provided us with a refreshing take on the Bob Crane case.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, that does it for this edition of
The Dark Side of Hollywood,
featuring journalist Albert Lanier. Any other infamous Hollywood cases and scandals you want us to cover, let me know. Hit me up on Twitter. Maybe we'll do it on a future edition of this series. One case that Albert and I have both definitively expressed an interest in and wanted to kick around for a future episode is the death of Natalie Wood. So that may be the next thing up our sleeves, folks. And if you liked this episode, found it intriguing, I'm sure you'll find upcoming editions to be just as fascinating. If you enjoyed this episode and the output of Parallax Views, please remember to donate to the Parallax Views Patreon page for exclusive bonus content. And with that being said, you've been listening to
The Dark Side of Hollywood.